way, I will be Chairman Pro Tem. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 3365. Baron Fleming Barrett.
Want me to?
I'd like to.
Yes. You don't even have a.
We're going to take testimony and
okay.
We won't take any action until we have a sufficient number. And as Representative Clory is well aware, the House is going to go into session at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So please proceed.
Okay. I'm State Representative Ted Clory from Washington County. I will immediately turn this over to those who know more than I. But let me just point out to you that as recently as last week, House Bill 3015 was passed on the floor, 59 zip, 59 to nothing, or close to that. Don't quote me totally, but it, among other things, said that statutes and local ordinances relating to notification of impending actions on properties should be notification of those should be sent to owners of record. It turns out that currently over 50% of rental properties in Oregon is under professional property management. And therefore, you would think that it would make sense to have notification be sent to those people too, and that was not done in 3015. And so this bill allows property management firms to record their agency contracts and then be participants in that notification, which seems to be a real practical matter. I think that there are a number of points that one could make about how that would be done to get them recorded and to, well, I won't go into all that. Actually, I'm starting to go into the details, and I'd just as soon not do that. I think that this makes sense. It probably makes the process better than the way that we passed it, not only just in terms of completeness and the kind of things that we were trying to accomplish in the other bill, but also in terms of just kind of fairness and seeing to it that that the realities of today's world are recognized. So that's all I will say. I would appreciate you passing it out when you do have enough, and I will let there are a number of other people who are willing to speak here. Go ahead.
Ms. Fleming-Barrett?
Yes, I've prepared testimony that I believe you've all received a copy of. I believe Representative Clory said it best. I'm not going to read to you. Our concern is exactly that. We're here to speak for the property managers that are the members of our two associations, and their concern is they are liable for up to $500 a day fines under some of the drug house ordinances, but have no way of receiving a notice that there's any illegal activity going on or suspected. So the person most likely to be able to solve the problem is left completely out of the process with the exception of the fine. We urge your support of 3365.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the witnesses?
Is this the only witness we're going to have on this tonight?
We have other witnesses signed up for on this bill.
Was this against torture in Turkey?
Yes, Representative Edmondson and Representative Baum. Our concern is there is no place without this bill for the managers to record their contracts so that whoever is going to mail notices can discover who to mail them to. This would allow us to record a summary of our property management contract with the title company. So in the title search, up would pop the property manager who would also be included in the notice process. Right now, there is no means of a county clerk or city clerk to discover who manages the property. I see. Yes, sir.
We have
no problem with that provision.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Stogsdill.
Thank you. afternoon. I'm Mary Stogsdale from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm the legislative chair of the Lane County Rental Owners Association. I was supposed to be signed up for 3287 and not for the other bill.
Oh, okay. Well,
please let me excuse myself and come back at a later time there for you.
I'll take you off the list then. Thank you, Mary. Max Chapman, please.
My name is Max Chapman. I own a property management company in Salem, Shelter Management Incorporated, and representing multifamily housing. For the sake of time, I just simply am here to support the bill. From the property manager's standpoint, if we were able to receive notice of this kind, we would certainly be able to act primarily for those owners that are out of state, because sometimes their mail doesn't get to us for a week or two if they decide to forward it on to us. But we're we're in support of this bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you. That's all the people who have signed up on this bill. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? Wait a minute. Genoa Hefke, I think. We're not signed up, but you passed a note up here that you want to testify. Do you have Sue with you also? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Genoa Hefke with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are here primarily today to testify on another bill, but our legislative committee did look at this bill, and it does have our support. And my purpose here right now, the primary purpose, is to introduce Sue O'Halloran, who is a property manager and president of the Gresham Board, who would be able to give a little more accurate description of what happens in the trenches and why this bill is necessary.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this would be extremely helpful. I'm sorry, Sue O'Halloran. I'm with 2020 Properties up in Portland, which does property management throughout the Portland metropolitan area, also with OAR and the Gresham Board of Realtors. We do not currently receive any type of notice when there is foreclosure unless our owner happens to tell us that that's occurring, and sometimes they choose not to. And what happens is that the tenant does not ordinarily then know what's going on until the foreclosure has occurred and he receives a notice that he needs to immediately vacate. Then we don't have an opportunity to prepare them, let them know that they need to find other housing. So we're not able to fulfill our 30-day notice obligation to them. It causes lots of hard feelings sometimes. We also obligate the property with repairs and maintenance, not being aware that there is foreclosure imminent. So I think this protects really all the properties involved and would give us an opportunity, if we suspect anything at all is happening, to then record our name with the county so it becomes public record. So I would recommend support of this.
Oh, I have a question for you. The property manager would have to take an affirmative step to have their name recorded.
Correct.
So that if you had not gone through that step, you wouldn't have a complaint then if you weren't notified.
That's right. The burden is on us then to take that step. If we are not the party making the mortgage payments, we might want to just automatically record ourselves. So, yes, the burden would be on us.
Any questions for these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3365? Okay, hearing none, I'll close that hearing and we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3287. I'm not going to go into work session until I want to move as many of our witnesses as we can. If we get into a call of the House, we're going to have to leave, and I don't want to leave them sitting up out there while we're taking time on a work session. Sharon Fleming Barrett, House Bill 3287.
It is a good bill.
Good afternoon. Allow me to introduce the organizations I'm here to represent today. The Affiliated Rental Housing Association is a statewide organization of 1,200 members in 14 local associations representing approximately 20,000 rental units. The Oregon Apartment Association, with a membership of 500-plus members, represents in excess of 10,000 rental units. Attached in this package that I've handed out, you'll find additional testimony from members of those associations. I also speak to you as a real estate investor and manager who is deeply concerned with the well-being and the best interests of the customers, my customers, the tenants, in my 800-plus units. We oppose House Bill 3287. We feel it will force rental owners to choose one of two options. We will either respond by charging all non-refundable fees or be forced to open individual savings accounts for each security deposit as the amount of labor necessary to track the small amount of interest involved and supply the necessary IRS reporting forms would be extremely costly and would result in increased rents. As we are striving to supply decent, affordable housing, this would be counterproductive. I personally use security deposits as an incentive for the resident to maintain my property in the best possible condition and to perform, as promised, the provisions of our mutual contract, the rental agreement. I feel this arrangement is mutually beneficial as it rewards the resident who keeps his commitment. The security deposit is also the only insurance a rental owner has to protect him against the resident who doesn't keep his commitment. For instance, non-payment of rent, damages to the property. By holding a refundable deposit, the landlord can at least collect a portion of the amount owed to him under those conditions. Passage of House Bill 3287 could result in the good resident no longer receiving the bonus of a return deposit for good performance, but being penalized by the institution of fees. We urge your opposition to House Bill 3287. Thank you.
Questions of the witness? Senator Calhoun.
I just saw this bill today. All this bill does is requires you to pay interest.
That is correct. We would have to track each individual tenant, the amount of rent or the amount of interest that they would accrue on a security deposit while it was in our possession. Correct, but when a tenant moves in, we don't know how long they'll be staying, so we would have to track from the first day. And tenants, as are all Americans, are nomadic now. I may have three or four tenants in an apartment in a given year. I would have to track each one of those deposits individually. I also would like to make an additional statement. I spoke with Michael Marcus, the Director of Litigation for Legal Aid, yesterday to ask if he would be here to testify on this bill. Mr. Marcus said, please, you may quote me for the record. I cannot get there. I do want the committee to be aware we have a negotiated package of landlord-tenant law changes coming, and this is not part of them. End quote.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. President Clark.
Maybe you touched on this in your testimony, but it's kind of a clumsy question, but what do you do with a security deposit now?
Security deposits are handled in more than one way. I'm a licensed real estate agent and a property manager, so by real estate law, I have to hold them individually. I have to hold them in a separate account from my operating funds. A rental owner who is not a licensed real estate person may use those funds for operating.
In your case, you have a separate account, sequestered fund, that you use for security deposits. Is that an interest-bearing account?
No, it is not. I have a separate trust account into which go the security deposits of 800 tenants.
It sits there. You're not earning interest on that.
Correct.
This bill passes. Isn't that an incentive or almost create a necessity for you to go put those funds in an interest-bearing account?
I would be forced, Representative Clark, to put them in 800 accounts, each one an individual account. The cost of hiring someone to come in and track the interest on those and prepare the IRS forms at the end of year for each individual tenant would not be cost effective to me. I'd have to raise rents I was going to hire a staff person. So what my personal choice would be go to the bank and open 800 accounts and put each deposit in its own account.
What I'm trying to do is correlate that with my experience with the with client trust accounts. And I've got to do the same thing with client trust account. Only now the state of Oregon has told me that the interest off of that is going to the Oregon Law Foundation, which is fine with me, because they do good things with the money. But I agree with you, it's an administrative hassle. I just wonder. Never mind. Thank you.
Further questions?
What is the average amount of deposit that you get?
Representative Mannix, my rentals range from $250 a month studios up to $1,000 a month houses. In the case of my apartments, the average, I would say, security deposit is $250, $200 to $250. In our single-family rentals, the security deposit is $50 less than a month's rent.
Last part.
In single-family dwellings, the security deposit is $50 less than 1 month's rent.
Yes, one other.
Do you currently put your security deposits into an interest-bearing account?
Representative Mannix, I do not. They are in a client's trust account that is non-interest-bearing.
Do you happen to know whether or not most other large managers do the same thing?
Not.
But is there some sort of a standard for property managers and owners that if they've got a lot of these accounts, they should have a client trust account?
If they're licensed real estate people, they must have a client trust account.
Just like we lucky lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm trying to get clear on what this is about. Do you currently have the right to put those monies into an interest-bearing account?
Yes, I do have the right to, so long as I have a written understanding with the owner and the tenant that will happen, and I disclose where the interest will go. And I have the right in that agreement to determine who will receive the interest.
And according to this bill, I think my reading of it is correct, and at the end of any given year, you simply pay the person 10% of the deposit amount. So if they had a $300 5%, excuse me. They had a $300 deposit at the end of each year, you have to give $15.
That's my understanding, yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Steubenvall and Louise Tippins, would you like to come up with her? I want to, just for the committee members and the parties, I want to apologize to the two of you. I see you're down on the list here, but you're the requesters and the sponsors of this bill, and so I appreciate the previous witness, who was the first on the list, giving her remarks, and maybe now you can tell us what the bill's about.
Submit this? My name is Louise Tippins, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Beverly Stein. And, yes, come on, we just started. And with me, I have John Steubenvall from Osberg and Senator Kennemer. Osberg requested us to submit House Bill 3287, because we agreed to do it because we think that it's an issue of fairness and that it's something that tenants deserve to have happen in Oregon. House Bill 3287 requires landlords to pay tenants a 5% annual interest on their deposits if the person has lived there for 1 year or more. And we see security deposits as a good faith act. It's a symbol of the good faith between the landlord and the tenant. And we think that if somebody has a significant amount of money tied up in a security deposit, that it's only fair that the person receive interest on this money. We're glad that Osberg suggested this bill. We think it's a good idea. We think that it would be a fair law. It's worked in other states. And we urge your passage. And I'm going to let John speak a little bit more to the bill, and Senator Kennemer has some remarks as well.
Go ahead, John.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Steubenvall. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. In our opinion, the issue before us today is really quite simple. It's an issue of who should benefit from the use of a person's money, the person, him or herself, or some third party. While money has a time value, and it is widely agreed that consumers deserve interest on their deposited funds, this concept has not yet been applied to landlord-tenant law in Oregon. There is no dispute in current Oregon statute that rental security deposits are the property of the tenant. current statute states, a security deposit shall be held by the landlord for the tenant who is a party to the rental agreement. However, there is a deficiency in this statute in that it does not recognize the time value of money. The statute provides for the return of all or part of the security deposit, but without interest. The statute, in effect, says that a dollar today is worth the same amount as a dollar 1 year from now. A dollar today is worth a dollar plus interest 1 year from now, and the interest on that dollar should be earned by the person who owns the dollar. Yet in current landlord-tenant law in Oregon, the person who holds the dollar is the one who benefits from the dollar's time value. House Bill 3287, as Louise said, is modeled on a state statute from Massachusetts. The bill affirms that a person making a deposit should earn interest on that deposit. And the legislation simply states that the deposit shall earn 5% per annum rate of return. Just in conclusion, Mr. Chair and members, Osberg feels that this legislation brings about a simple issue of fairness. Tenants should be the ones who benefit from the use of their own money. And we urge the subcommittee to act favorably on this bill, which would bring more equity into the landlord-tenant law.
I guess I'm the chair.
Senator, chair?
Do you have some comments?
I'm sorry,
Representative Clark.
No, I'd like to hear from Senator Kinnemer.
Senator Kinnemer, why don't you go ahead and then we'll take some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members, appreciate the opportunity to be here. For the record, I'm State Senator Bill Kinnemer from District 12 in Clackamas County. I'm coming today in support of this measure as a result of some problems that some mobile home tenants have had in my district. In doing some research, I found that Sue Hanna of the Legislative Council did say that this was amending landlord-tenant law and that these security deposits would be applicable to mobile home park space rentals. And specifically in my district, during some of the recent short supply of mobile homes, people were charging move-in fees that would be refundable when you eventually left. And I have two parks in my district who at one point charged fees as high as $5,000 without interest. In my view, this represented an abuse, and I had planned to introduce legislation to deal with that and did not get it in, and just recently was reminded of that, and so I started looking through and found that this was a vehicle that dealt with it. I'd also point out that as I understand the bill, it does not allow grandfathering, so it would not do anything for these people, but at least it would protect them in the future, and that's the reason for my support today. I might add also, a couple of other people paid $2,500 deposits. So we're talking about very significant deposits, and I know of at least five instances personally of those substantial deposits without interest.
Representative Clark, question?
Yeah, for Mr. Steubenbaum, let's say that I'm an extremely well-organized landlord, and I've got it figured out that my time plugged into my business is worth $40 an hour. And that complying with House Bill 3287 is going to take me an hour per tenant. And I charge a $100 deposit, and 5% that tenant's going to get back $5 at the end of the year. What's to keep me from just saying, okay, $40 an hour, I'm just going to increase the rent per unit $40 per year? Does anybody really win under that circumstance? What have we accomplished at that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I guess if we assume that scenario is correct, you're probably correct. I guess we have a difficult time believing that this legislation is that in any way that difficult to implement. The bill is extraordinarily simple. One could comply with the requirements of this bill with a pocket calculator. It's really quite that simple. So I guess we can't believe that it really is that difficult and takes that long to comply with this simple statute.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question. Do landlords, do they customarily charge interest on back rents the tenants back 30 days on rent and subsequently pay their rent. Do they routinely across the state charge an interest rate once that payment is made in full?
Mr. Chair, it's our understanding that that does vary from situation to situation, agreement to agreement. But in my own situation, in past situations in which I've rented, that has been the situation where there would be some sort of late payment fee. But that sort of arrangement would not be under the jurisdiction of the subject of this legislation, because this legislation deals with refundable deposits.
I guess I'm trying to get to the issue of fairness, and I was wondering the balancing side of that is that if a tenant fails to pay their monthly rent, and if landlords are precluded from charging interest or collecting interest, then it would seem to balance things out. It was just a thought of mine, that's all.
Well, Mr. Chair, we certainly don't argue with, if a tenant is delinquent in a rental payment, we certainly don't quarrel with the landlord's ability to charge some sort of late payment fee. That's not what this bill is about.
Well, thank you very much. Any other testimony?
Mr. Chairman, just one additional comment. You know, one of the ways to deal with with Representative Clark's objection might be to look at establishing a minimum amount, which might also be a way of encouraging indirectly deposits to be kept low.
Right.
Right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Appreciate
you.
The opportunity.
Thank you.
Genoa Hefke and Susan O'Halloran.
Mr. Chairman, or members of the committee, Genoa Hefke with the Oregon Association of Realtors. On the surface, this looks like a good idea. It looks like a good bill. However, as we see it, if this bill goes through, the property managers are left with two and only two alternatives. The first is to increase the rents to offset the extra administrative costs of taking care of this problem. The second thing is to make all deposits non-refundable, and we fail to see how either of those options are going to benefit the tenant. This does create an extra layer of paperwork. I have brought Sue with me today to describe to you exactly what a property manager has to do to keep their filings straight with the IRS and what have you. Again, we oppose this bill. We think that it's not going to help the tenants, and it's certainly not going to help the property managers. And with that, I appreciate your consideration of Sue, who is willing to go into further detail.
Thank you. Sue O'Halloran with 2020 Properties. We manage property throughout the Portland metropolitan area, and we're members of the Gresham Board of Realtors and the Oregon Association of Realtors. Most of the property, I believe, here in Oregon is probably under property management care. If it's under property management care, it falls under licensees. And we are required under rules and regulation with the Oregon Real Estate Agency to have those funds in client trust accounts. Client trust accounts have to be accounted for down to the penny. That means that every one of these tenants, regardless of whether they stay there a year or not, we have to begin tracking them and figuring out what their interest has been earned to that particular date. And then, of course, we need to decide. If they haven't earned that interest, then our owner has earned that interest. So that means not only do we have to prepare 1099s for those tenants at the end of the year who may have accrued interest, but we also have to prepare 1099s for those owners who would have accrued interest during that interim period where we've had tenants who have had stayed lesser times. What that really results in is a large amount of paperwork. It amounts to man hours and time far exceeding what the average would be earning. In our area, talking to some of the other property management companies there, they figure that their average deposit that they hold, which is refundable, is about $300. That equates to $15 a year. The amount of manpower and time that's involved in the accounting process is significantly cost. I can't even really begin to estimate, but I know it's significant. So really what will happen is that tenant will not benefit. We will either charge some non-refundable fees will change from refundable to maybe last month rent, some other kinds of ways, because nobody can support that kind of cost. The owner can't support that kind of cost. We can't support that kind of cost. So ultimately, it is going to be borne by that tenant who supposedly is going to receive a benefit. So we do oppose this as not in the best interest of the ultimate consumer, who is the tenant.
So Halloran, I believe council has a question for
yes.
And thank you. When I lived in Virginia, I lived in an apartment and had a security deposit, and by law they're required to pay interest on the security deposit. Have you been able to check with any other states as to what the cost that they incur in administering security deposits?
I'm not aware that our neighboring states have been doing that, and no, I've not had an opportunity to do that.
Okay. Representative Calhoun, question?
I'm a little bit confused here, because it would seem to me before the big bad government gets involved, it would be fairly simple to shove these monies into an interest-bearing account, and anybody can figure 5% a year fairly simply. If it's $100, that's $5. If it's $200, that's $10, and so on.
This is an association made up of approximately 300 members representing 3,000 units of property in the Lane County area. You've heard extensive testimony about the cost of management of those accounts, and so I will not go into that again from a management company's perspective, but I'd like to look at it from a small owner perspective, which is basically what our organization is made up of. The obligation of 5% interest is not the significant part to us. It's the cost of maintaining those records and issuing disbursements against that amount. If House Bill 3287 were to pass, our membership would be encouraged to recoup those costs through increased rents. And the increased rents would cover the cost of the expenses of bookkeeping and management of the disbursements. Our objective, though, is not to injure the tenant, but rather to provide housing for those tenants who are our customers. And in this time of a crisis of affordable housing needs, I would rather not see increased rents become a sufficient problem because of this bill. The 5% interest payment would not be sufficient over a year's time at $5 to $20 probably of income to the tenant. It would not be sufficient to render any help to the tenant, and yet the added into the other expenses of management, it would increase the cost of housing to the tenant, and probably more so than $5 to $20 per year. So it would not be advantageous, but would be a detriment to the renters to add more expenses. So I ask that you look into the entire picture when you decide your position on this bill, and the Rental Owners Association of Lane County is opposed to the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Edmondson.
Mary, how many of your members, I'm going to use the word mom and pop very advisedly here, but and I should tell you and everybody else in the committee that I was reluctantly forced into becoming a landlord when I couldn't sell my house in Eugene and went into the rental market. So I kind of have a feel for this problem. How many of your members are people like me who just have one house and they have no intention of being a big real estate management company, and we just assume not have to sell our property at a loss, so we've got it in the rental market?
Representative Edmondson, Chairman Bauman, as I understand it, something like 65% of our members own six units or less in the Eugene organization. And at six units or less, I don't know who owns only one unit or two units, but that's substantial in our area that it is small owners who make up the membership of our organization. Most of the multi-property organizations are members of Multifamily Housing Council, which serves their interests a little more completely than Rental Owners Association does.
If this bill had some sort of a minimum amount, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but basically, the small rental owner, if you will, would not be subject to this kind of a law. Would that make your association more comfortable with it?
No, I don't think so, because as an industry, we do look at the entire picture, and for the entire industry, I don't think it would be a good bill. I don't think it would serve the purpose that the renters would like for it to serve in writing the bill. If I thought it would really serve that purpose without hurting that same interest, I could probably be much more neutral about it. You're welcome.
Thank you. Now, I want to return the committee to House Bill 2668 as a work session, so we have an opportunity to review the amendments that have been brought to us.
Madam Chair, where did these amendments come from?
Well, Counsel, can you enlighten us here?
Sure, Madam
and we
Chair.
Also have
I believe these amendments were the amendments that Representative Mannix proposed in concept at the last meeting that we had on this bill. Am I correct, Representative?
I think so. Sure. I'm getting nervous about amending bills these days.
Go right ahead, Representative Mannix.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
I have a question for whoever the proponent of the amendments is or are. And it has to do with the language on line 12 about mental injury to a child. Did we get testimony on that?
I am the progenitor of the amendments.
Representative Mannix.
We had discussion during the hearing of the issue of sexual, physical, or psychological abuse. There is a problem with the term psychological. I can't say that I've authored these amendments. I had come up with a conceptual amendment about the age factor. But we were still debating what we wanted to do. Well, the witnesses were discussing what we wanted to do on the psychological part. That was a problematic area.
Yeah, I'll just say right now that's a problematic area for me because I don't know what that is. And I know what physical injury is. I know what sexual abuse is. I know what sexual exploitation is. I know what child pornography is. All of those things are set out there. I don't know what mental injury is. And I can sure imagine that... If I were a little bit spicier than I am, I'd sue my dad for plenty of mental injury that he did to me as I was growing up. And I have problems with that line. And
it's the sharper than a serpent's tongue.
Yeah. I'm mentally injured today. I know that.
I
know the source of that mental injury.
I think that that is a real sore point in this bill. And actually, remember, we're just extending the statute of limitations to the extent that there are any psychologically based causes of action. The standard statute of limitations can still apply. The thrust of the bill originally was not to bring any kind of extension in that kind of case. It just came up during the discussion. I think that there is a real concern about trying to define what a mental injury is.
Is there any reason for us to define child abuse in this measure that's seeking to extend the statute of limitations for reporting something that I'm assuming is already defined in some other statute or that has a working definition in common law? Can you help us out, Judy? I mean, I don't think that our object here, we're not intending to create a new definition for child abuse here.
Madam Chair, we wrestled a bit with that at the last session, and we're trying to find some sort of a means of limiting the original concept of 2668 to deal solely with the child abuse situation. I wasn't trying to do it. You were trying to do that. And child abuse, I think, has a common understanding, and perhaps that might even translate into a common law understanding, but it certainly does not have a statutory definition, except as you would find in the Oregon Criminal Code. Or I think you could also turn to the Juvenile Code under the termination and neglect statutes and look at the language that is found in those provisions. The potential advantage of defining child abuse in this situation is limited. I don't think inappropriately limited, but limited by the fact that Section 3 makes it clear that nothing in this Act creates a new cause of action. And so I, yes, yes.
I also understand, counsel is looking right now, but I also understand that this is the current criminal code definition of child abuse. And we'll check on that.
We had also spent, pardon me if I may, Madam Chair, we'd also spent some time talking at the last session about the limitations on recovery of emotional distress damages and that you need to have intentional conduct to get emotional distress or physical injury to get emotional distress or the outrageous conduct. So there are already limitations in the law. And again, this would not create a new cause of action.
I appreciate the feedback. I'm trying to make the connection between the, if in fact this is existing criminal code definition, it may or may not be appropriate for a civil definition. I mean, there's different purposes there, and I'm trying to figure out which way that cuts. What I don't want is a bunch of people reaching the age of enlightenment, which we all know is 19, when you know everything, and suing their parents for mental injury. That's what I, you know, all these years they've had all this anger built up, and I realize you'd still have to satisfy the intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is difficult but not impossible. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. And I guess I'd just be more comfortable with line 12 out.
Representative, oh, go ahead.
I'd be more comfortable with line 12 out, and I could support the bill unreservedly then.
Let me ask
line 12 in, it causes me problems.
Let me add my question here, because I'm looking at this. This is just going to expose my ignorance, but now is a better time than after the bill comes out. I'm concerned that we have intentional conduct, which could be, for example, Representative Clark intentionally coming to the legislature, which creates some sort of neurotic syndrome in his child. I don't want to make you leave the committee hearing and go running home, Representative Clark. Well, there you go.
She did tell me the other day that I didn't love her when I was in Salem.
The conduct is intentional. This is a law school question I'm asking. We've put you through this ringer before. The conduct is intentional. The result is certainly not intentional. Is this a Hornbook question?
Well, it's a question, if I may, Madam Chair, that the Oregon courts have wrestled with very recently. And what it brings to mind is the situation that I found myself in, or my firm has, where we've attempted to bring under a homeowner's policy a claim against the homeowner's insurance for sexual abuse of a child occurring on the premises of the defendant. Thus far, we've been unsuccessful through suits for declaratory judgment. A recent suit for declaratory judgment has resulted in a finding that even though the conduct was intentional, the consequence, the harm, was not intentional. Therefore, the liability carrier was not to be found liable because it was truly intentional conduct.
It was intentional conduct. The result, the consequence, was not intended. Therefore,
the homeowner is still out. The homeowner's insurance is out. We had attempted to argue that although the conduct was intentional, the individual did not intend the harm, and we have to assume that a person who abuses the child in most cases does not intend to, within the concept of their own priorities, has not established as a priority actually harming the child. The harm just occurs as a consequence of the intentional act.
And you have to, Madam Chair, you have to go through that hoop because of the difficulty of proving intentional infliction of an emotional distress, right? I mean, you have to prove that what I was after wasn't to satisfy some strange thing in my head, but was actually to make this person upset.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, yes, that would be the burden on the plaintiff,
right,
if we were attempting to recover emotional distress damages, mental injury,
right,
in the absence of physical injury.
Right. Interesting.
Now, clearly the situation is different if you have the physical injury, and presumably it would be different
would be
whether you're dealing with a parent or
right,
with a
be different
third party.
Here too. Yeah.
Representative Calhoun.
I'm not sure about this, and this isn't where I practice, but it's kind of as a follow-up to Representative Clark's question. Could a child currently, under our present law, sue their parents as long as the conduct occurred within 5 years or within 18? So, I mean, can't they currently take the same kind of suit Clark is contemplating, but they just can't go back quite as far as they
can? Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, that's right, because we're not creating any new causes of action. We're only extending the period of time within which the minor may bring an action.
Thank you. Are there any other questions while we have Ms. Snyder here to answer these questions? Representative Mannix.
I'd like to, I had only seen these amendments today, and I'd like to just check on a couple of points. We were talking about there's a longer definition in the code actually as to this mental abuse, which has got a lot of limitations in it there's a limitation phrase that's not in here. But what is your reaction to saying child abuse means intentional physical injury to a child, intentional mental injury to a child, and then add the limiting language that Mr. Taylor has in front of him? Perhaps you could read that phrase. It might help Representative Clark, too.
Okay, if I could, Madam Chair. Any mental injury to a child which shall include only observable and substantial impairment of the child's mental or psychological ability to function caused by cruelty to the child, with due regard to the culture of the child.
Are you comfortable with that kind of language?
Madam Chair and Representative Mannix, yes to the last part, no to the first. The language that has been read, I'm familiar with that, although I can't place it. Is that from the juvenile code or the criminal code?
OS 418-740, reporting of child abuse.
From the juvenile code. Clearly, that is language that already has some structure and bears some definition within the context of current Oregon case law. And I would think that that would help to clarify what we're talking about with respect to mental injury. But Representative Mannix, you had suggested intentional physical injury or intentional mental injury. That burden, I don't believe, should be placed upon the child to prove that the parent intended to cause physical, not parent, the adult, the offender.
All right,
intended.
So I see. Well, the problem we're going to have is that the ecclesia offense defense, we didn't intend to kill her. We only intended to punish her.
Yes.
Okay. Well, how about just child abuse? May I have one more question?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Child abuse means physical injury to a child, mental injury to a child. They're still, as far as causes of action goes, they're going to have to prove all the tort standards once they get into that.
Yes, that's my expectation.
All right.
May I assume you shortened it, that you're referring child abuse means intentional conduct by an adult that results in any physical injury.
I took out that to just say child abuse means, now I'd say physical injury to a child, mental injury to a child, and then get into the others. But I'd add the careful phraseology regarding mental injury.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yeah.
I only ask you to think about what that might mean. If you don't have intentional in, that could potentially also include negligent conduct, which causes physical injury, an automobile collision. And while my organization, I'm sure, would support that, I'm not certain that that's the direction that the House would ultimately want to head.
You're comfortable with the original phraseology, intentional conduct by an adult? That results in any physical injury to a child?
Well, the choices are intentional, negligent, or reckless, if I remember correctly.
I'm concerned with the breakdown of the statute here, too. It says intentional conduct by an adult that results in, we talk about physical injury, any mental injury, then we get into sexual abuse of a child. Well, that's not a result, that is an act. But that's phraseology. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Clark.
One last question, Mr. Snyder. Would Would you object to removing the language in line 12 as supporter of the bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, I would respectfully request that that language be retained, in that I could contemplate the possibility that an adult would engage in intentional conduct, perhaps even with the intent to cause mental distress. And I'm thinking of the circumstances, and I don't know if I'll articulate this very well just off the top of my head, but the circumstance in which a parent or adult intentionally seeks to demean the child or to, thank you, I was thinking of this earlier, lock the child in a closet or lock the child in a basement or do something that is outrageous, you know, far beyond just punishment. It doesn't cause actual physical injury, so that we don't have that component. But based under the scrutiny of current law, and remember, we're not creating any new causes of action, but certainly under current law, that would be outrageous conduct, which would give a child a cause of action for those mental injuries, even though there had been no physical harm.
Can I follow up on that?
Representative Mannix.
What about that limiting language that I had the council read on mental injury? Are you have any problem with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I hope we don't lose our vote on this, because I think we may be ready to wrap up this bill.
Yeah, I have that feeling, too, and I think, Representative Baum, you might want to be here to register your vote.
I have a motion if we're in work session.
We're in work session. If it wasn't before, we are now.
I would move the -1 amendments to 2668, modified slightly as follows. And I'm modifying lines 9 through 12 only. On line 9, we would insert a colon after means. So it would read, as used in subsection 1 of this section, child abuse means colon. And I'm going to try to break this down more cleanly. Then we'd have subsection A, intentional conduct by an adult that results in any physical injury to a child, semicolon. Subsection B, intentional conduct by an adult that results in any mental injury to a child, plus the additional language that Council Taylor read from the ORS that limits the mental injury. That's the one change that I would make to the -1 amendments.
Can we make this change conceptually, so that I just asked counsel if it's sufficient to refer to 418.470 rather than repeat the language again in the statute.
Could we leave that to the discretion of legislative council?
I'd like to leave it.
That would be fine with me. As long as we have that limit, the intention of my amendment is to clean up this language here a little bit and add in the limitation on mental injury as is in the ORS citation.
That's helpful.
So, Madam Chair, what would be on line 12 after the word child would either insert the language that's in 418.740, or we would add reference to that particular section at that
yes.
place. Am I correct? Thanks.
Your Madam Chair.
Representative. Just briefly, Representative Mannix, your amendment would then leave subsections C and D as written, but they would actually be broadened because the language now would make those subject to the intentional conduct modifier, so that basically negligent or reckless sexual abuse or exploitation would be now included in within the definition.
That's right.
I don't have any problem with that. I just wanted to make sure that's clear.
Representative Calhoun.
Real hyper-technical in trying to pull things out of the juvenile code or the criminal code. Come up with some lengthy statute to try to define something. if I recall correctly, and I don't practice civil law, but if I recall correctly, for the most part, you can break things up depending upon the state of intent of the act. So that if we strictly limited this to intentional acts, it would be able to reach pretty much the same intent.
Well, may I respond?
Sure.
The reason why I'm limiting mental injury is in response to Representative Clark's concern. I was happy with it as it was, but I can understand his concern, and I think it's a legitimate concern that I thought members of the committee might want to address. And I would actually prefer that we just take that phrase from that bill, and I'm hoping Legislative Council will agree, but they may not agree, to just define mental injury to limit that way. So that it's just clean, it's right in the statute. I want these other statements in here because they're very clear as to what, they're well thought out provisions as to what kinds of things we want to extend the statute of limitations on.
Can you call for a question on this proposal?
Thank you. Representative Baum has called the question. On the proposed amendment, is there any question about that amendment? Not discussion, but question of about what the amendment contains. Representative Calhoun. I appreciate that, circle call the roll, please. Take a recess. Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration is back in order. We have a motion. We have Representative Mannix's motion before us on the amendments. Is there any objection to the amendments on House Bill 2668 as modified by Representative Mannix? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Mannix has moved House Bill 2668 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Calhoun.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Edmondson.
Aye.
Mannix.
Aye.
Chair Baum.
Aye. Left somebody out here.
Representative Minnis.
Me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative
Minnis. You have to vote last, Representative Minnis.
Aye. As your most important.
Motion carries. We also had a bill earlier in the afternoon.
Madam Chair.
And I'd like to go into work session.
I appreciate your courtesy with the short recess and Representative Mannix's help on that. It gave me just enough time to do what I needed to do to get comfortable with the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate your concerns, Representative Clark, and I'm sorry. I felt like I had sort of mauled you a little bit there, so glad it helped. On House Bill 3365.
Are we going into work session on that?
We're in work session on House Bill 3365.
Madam Chair, I move. May I?
Do you have an amendment?
No.
You moved to House Bill 3365. Representative Mannix moves House Bill 3365 with no amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
I just need to find it.
This is Representative Flory's bill. Very fine bill.
Oh, Flory's bill.
Okay. All right.
Good bill should
There's
pass.
Obviously a tribute here since this is being moved without amendment. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Edmondson?
Yes.
Aye.
Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Bowman?
Aye. Motion carries. We are in... I really need a script here. We're in public hearing on House Bill 2930. Carl Decker?
He left.
Frank Bronner will be the gentleman. Mr. Bronner, we have some amendments to the bill. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association.
I wanted to make sure you had to stay at least as long as we did, Mr. Bronner, Mr. Markey.
It's a pleasure. The amendment would come on the dash one amendments that you have on page 3, lines 24 and 25. The deletion of the sentence, a copy of a writ of garnishment shall constitute reasonable notice. I might tell you that this amendment has been agreed to by legal aid and by the proposer of the amendment, who sits to my right.
Thank you. That's clear. I'm looking for a copy of the amendment.
Which number of amendments are these?
It's, Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, it's the dash one amendments.
I'm sorry. Do you
have a copy? LC 2947.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I might, Jim Markey, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, we had had a concern about reasonable notice and had asked the committee to consider a copy of the writ serving as reasonable notice. And while that, in many instances, would constitute reasonable notice, the concern of legal aid and also of the state court administrator's office was that there would be times when that might not be reasonable notice, and so we've agreed to take that out, and I think if all parties have agreed to simply let the reasonable notice standard be in effect as it's as it is without that language, and we'll argue about what reasonable notice is in the exemption hearing, I guess. Say that.
So that we're completely clear on this, it is not your intent to make a copy of writ of garnishment not reasonable notice, if you follow what I'm saying.
No.
So that